Recorded live in downtown Newtown, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Welcome everybody to Season 2, Episode number 11 of Rancho Notorious. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in Wellington, New Zealand, Kaylee Carruthers. G'day, Kaylee.
Hi.
And on the line, I should probably establish exactly where you are on the line from. Steve Gray, where are you at the moment?
Hello, Daniel. It's lovely to be with you.
It's lovely to have you on.
Kaylee, how are you?
Good, I'm doing well. Where are you?
I'm in Hamilton.
Well,
the great Mecca of Hamilton.
And
yeah, don't be rude about it. I'm just over that. People are so horrible about it. It's like the Des Moines of New Zealand.
No, those gardens, they have those beautiful gardens, though.
And the river.
Yeah.
And the river.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
And the river.
I've always enjoyed my brief stays in Hamilton. I've been there for sports fixtures and various other things. And, like, oh, no, I'm not going to be rude about Hamilton. Mm. And besides, it's where you are. So, you know, it's great.
I raise its cool quotient hugely.
Now, for those people that are unfamiliar with your oeuvre, Steve, you are a film reviewer, blogger, former television personality, and an online presence. This is how I've tried to describe you. Would that be fair comment? As if I missed anything?
I think any of us like being called bloggers now because of the whole whale oil debacle. And I've always called what I do a bloggy webby thing, which has changed so much because when it started it was so gossipy and now it's turned so political because the world's changed so much since I started 5 years ago. So you've got to keep up with the times.
Indeed. So it's not like an online journal anymore, is it? I mean, you basically...
Well, I never do. I hate blog. The whole people just vomiting out their subconscious and stuff. I think it's... And my way of looking at it now is getting information out. I see stuff and I think, oh, that's cool. And so it's sort of a mix of everything that you can possibly think of, really. And keeping people up to date of what's going on with TV and politics. Both things I love. And movies, of course, because I'm sort of back... Cause, you know, because when I was reviewing, I was watching like 600 movies a year. And I was exhausted by the end. So I had about a year off. So now I'm back watching films again, which I'm kind of liking.
And you also, as I say, you're across an enormous amount of popular culture. We're going to talk about television a little bit later on because this show is not just about movies, but we're very keen to direct people's attention to all sorts of things that they should be watching. So a little bit later on in the show, we're going to ask you for your tips for 2015's essential television, if you like. Yeah, exactly, the good stuff. On the show today, the three of us are going to be reviewing the biggest films that have opened since the last time we were together. We're a fortnightly show now. So, of course, we're going to talk about Reese Witherspoon going off the beaten track in Wild and the Johnny Depp star vehicle Mordecai, which no doubt will be an entertaining discussion. Kaylee and Steve are going to be previewing The Theory of Everything because you two have actually seen that.
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay, so maybe Steve...
I have, so that's lucky.
That's because you're one of us has. I perhaps should have checked all of this before we started recording. And Steve, you've seen Selma as well, which also opens today. Yeah. So we'll have a little bit of a discussion about because it is Oscar season, and of course this is probably the key week in terms of releasing big Oscar movies out into the wild. And because this is a show about, as I said, all sorts of cool stuff, we're going to be asking Steve about the latest and greatest in the world of television because, you know, amazingly, he has time to stay abreast of all of that, too.
As well.
Yeah. But let's not bugger about. Kaylee, you are in control of the mailbag. It has been fulsome.
It has been. And thank you, as we, you know, thank you now every fortnight for your tweets. We love them. We love reading them. It's a nice little break from work sometimes. Sam McCosh, did a lovely tweet. She listed us as her top 20 podcasts she is listening to right now. Thank you very much. We're very honored to be on that.
Did you see who else she listens to that we are included in that list? I mean, some of the really big, the big names, Commode and Mayo are in there. This is the kind of circles that we're moving in now,
excellent,
ladies and gentlemen.
Excellent. let's see. What else is there?
See, you're really well prepared.
I enjoy rereading these things. It's hard to choose one. Right, Reese Pie made the big announcement.
Yes.
On the 30th of Jan, we are go on Letterboxd. So now at the end of the show, when we tell you our Letterboxd handle, there's actually stuff there because Reese Pie, bless her heart, is managing our Letterboxd for us because she is a movie angel.
Yeah, so it's fantastic. And I noticed that got retweeted by Letterboxd themselves, which means we now have the seal of approval from Letterboxd Central. Mm-hmm. And I'm updating as well on Letterboxd. I've decided that, now that because their mobile site is so good, it's really easy to see walking out of a movie to just and bash it out. Two words.
That's something I should really get into doing.
You should.
I should.
Yeah. Because now that you're on Radio New Zealand in an official capacity.
Well, official filling capacity, yes.
Yeah, but that's all right. I mean, I was a ring-in for a long time, but, now I'm, in the upper echelons, in the esteemed company of, I get to hang out with Catherine Ryan
and people. Yeah, and I got to go on Wellington Access Radio this week as well.
No.
Yeah, and I got to talk about Rancho Podcast.
Look at that.
Dan Slevin, you are getting me gigs left, right, and center. Reese Pie also went to see Foxcatcher. Her two-word review was consistently unsettling.
I'm really
consistently bad.
Oh, ouch! I'm really envious of anybody who's seen Foxcatcher, just because of the fact that they haven't released it in our town yet.
No.
Is it really?
No, for some reason it's like going back into the 1980s. So they're releasing it. They've released it in Auckland. And it goes to Dunedin in late February, and then we get it in March for some reason.
I thought it was very coy.
Right. Well, we might get you back on to talk about that because it does appear to be a film that's divided not just audiences, but even the people who made it or contributed to it seem to have problems with it.
Mm. Yeah, he went crazy about it.
That's the subject, hey? The wrestler guy. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember Mark Schultz. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it later.
Yep.
Fred Thompson sent us a whole pile of two-word reviews, so I'll just pick two at random. Two-word review for Wild, introspective self-help, raw and gritty performance from Witherspoon, but it ultimately felt bland and contrived.
Oh, we're going to talk about that later on. Let's not jump into that one too early.
No. And two-word review for Still Alice, honest and heartfelt, beautifully developed and compassionate with an acting masterclass from Moore.
Well, I know that we've
two-word review, disease porn.
See, this is one we've all seen, isn't it? Still Alice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was really angry with it. I thought it was like, oh, this poor woman.
Yeah, I have to say that my fiance and I went to see it, and we were really quite affected by it, and partly because I think that's not to say that you are not in the same age group, Steve, but, the character's 50 and we're closing in on 50. And I think we felt quite connected to it, in terms of the potential for random medical disaster to befall us.
I think you're forgetting, I'm 50 this year and also I live through HIV, so I'm pretty used to people suddenly not being there because like died.
Yeah.
And I still didn't feel, I wasn't connected with it. Sorry, carry on.
No. I think this is we all come to these things from our own different perspectives. And, we were sitting there in an audience that didn't know a lot of the details of this particular disease, first of all that early onset Alzheimer's was even a thing. Like, I didn't even know that that existed, or that it was a genetically passed on thing. And then when there's that scene early on with the doctor where he says, there's a 50% chance that you've passed this on to your kids, and she says, well, what chance? If they've got the gene, what's the chance that they'll get it? And he said 100%. And you could tell that, like, everybody in the audience gasped at that point because they just didn't know that this was even a thing. And so there was that sort of educational side for me and that emotion. But I thought that I just really enjoyed a film that relied really, really heavily on one actor and just let that actor do their work. And, you know, how often scenes in that film were just close-ups of Julianne Moore while other stuff's going on in the background, just watching her react to other people talking to her, not sort of going cutting backwards and forwards between people. I thought that there was a really nice sense of trust that she will be able to carry it.
In the end, the film boiled down to me that old joke with Bethany about having dementia. You don't remember, you have it. And that's what those last scenes it turned into, and I found it quite despicable.
Okay, despicable. Despicable. Like, do you feel it was inauthentic, or there was milking the disease for a particular reason, or just you just not interested in that?
I have a friend with dementia at the moment who's 41, so I've kind of actually like been through this quite recently, and so it should have ripped my heart out. And I've never particularly bonded with Moore as an actor. She's never moved me particularly before, and I could see what they were trying to do. I just don't think it, I mean, I saw it around the same time as Theory of Everything, which we'll talk about later, which I thought really hit the money. You live with disease and you live with illness rather than you die or you suffer. I always find the language they use around these things quite unsettlingly unreal and not what you have to do when you're actually in it. And so, yeah, it just didn't work for me at all. And I was at the end of it, I was just like, it annoyed me immensely.
Okay.
But I have had some people have liked it.
Well, I can understand why that might be. I know that in our case, we were quite taken with it. Kaylee, what did you think?
It definitely wasn't my favorite Julianne Moore film. And I'm not surprised that she was nominated for an Oscar for her performance because, you know, playing someone with a degenerative illness, that's Oscar bait. But if she won the Oscar because she hasn't won before, I'd be really disappointed because I think she should have won for earlier roles where she was much stronger.
I hate that term too, like, you know, they're winning for their body of work. It's like, no, you went for that role.
You would hope. I'm interested in the filmmakers behind this, the writer-directors, Richard Glatzer, Wash West Milan, two names that I didn't know before. And I reviewed the film on Radio New Zealand last week, and so I had to do a little bit of research behind them. And it turns out that one of them's, at the moment in terms of their career, one of them's a producer and one of them's a director on America's Next Top Model. And
wow.
Yeah, and they're as a partnership, their introduction to feature film making was, and you might be familiar with this, Steve, a film called The Fluffer. About 15 years ago.
Wow. It's actually quite a good film.
Right. But apparently, and this is all down to Wikipedia, which we know we can only marginally trust, but evidently Wash Westmoreland, Wash not being his real born first name, when they were researching the gay porn industry for the movie, feature film they made, he actually started getting real gigs as a director. So he's actually got this incredible gay porn career.
That's wonderful.
Let's keep it PG, people.
Yeah, exactly. We won't go into too much more detail about that, but I just thought that was fascinating. Like, who... I, in some ways, if anything, Still Alice is this incredibly restrained example of their work.
But it was, I believe it was referred to as disease porn earlier. So yeah. That's right on the money, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, so we'll close up the mailbag at this point.
I'm afraid to read any more tweets.
Okay. Thanks very much for everybody who's contacted us, and we love your two-word reviews. It's just fantastic that you're continuing to send them to us. It's time to have a look at what's been going on in the world of the international box office. Oh, actually, the New Zealand box office. We'll do them first.
Yes, in Helvetica. Beautiful Helvetica. Mm. Title in italics.
Top five.
Right. In at number five, opening at five, is Wild. In at number four, sitting at number four, Big Hero 6.
Still going strong, actually.
Yeah, which is so good.
It is very good, isn't it?
Yeah, there's actually very little change this week from last week. Did I say number three already?
What's no, you didn't.
On? Okay,
no.
Sorry. Number three is The Imitation Game, sitting at number two, Unbroken, and still in the number one spot after 3 weeks, American Sniper.
Which is interesting in itself, in that at this point in time, there are no American military bases in New Zealand, so it must be all civilians who are going to see that.
Plainclothes civilians.
Indeed. Having a look at Australia, their top five, The Wedding Ringer is number five, has made $2 million Australian dollars. The Wedding Ringer 2, I can see it in our future. The Imitation Game, number four in Australia. Paper Planes is number three, $7 million in Australian dollars. Paper Planes, I had a quick look at the forward schedule here in New Zealand, but still no sign of it on the New Zealand schedule. We got a reply from Sonal, who's one our Brisbane correspondent, and because we asked about this, you know, what is Paper Planes, and apparently it's this family movie, total soft-headed sort of bring families together in quest of some kind of competition prize, sort of, you know, the kind of film that everybody makes once a year. Do you know anything about it, Steve?
Never heard of it.
Yeah, and probably will. You know, this is interesting. It's distributed by Roadshow, and so chances are they will not roll the dice on the New Zealand box office on it. Number two, The Theory of Everything. Is number one in the Australian box office. These two have just swapped, actually. American Sniper was number two last week. American Sniper number one this week in the Australian box office. What's going on in the United States? Oh, no, North America. Well, it's not.
Yes. North America. In at number five is The Boy Next Door, which I've just looked up. It's about Jennifer Lopez's character decides to flirt with her younger neighbor, and it sounds cute.
Jennifer Lopez, is she still around?
Yeah, she's in this movie. Sounds creepy. in at number four, Black or White. Not sure what that one's about either.
Is Black or White the... I'm going to look that up now while you're doing the other.
Cool. In at number three is Paddington. Number two...
Yay for Paddington, by the way.
Yay for Paddington. Number two, Project Almanac, which is opening in New Zealand soon, or has opened today.
Opens today.
Yeah. And in the number one position, American Sniper. And also, very interesting, IMDb Movie Meter, just so we can get our hashtag in. Number four, Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Number three, Birdman. Number two, Fantastic Four, which has come up from number 277.
All right, and this is the Fantastic Four that hasn't even come out yet. This is there's only a teaser trailer for it. That's why it's number two on the IMDb charts.
Yes, and also Game of Thrones had its trailer come out for the next season as well. Game of Thrones. And number one, American Sniper. So that is what people are interested in on the interwebs of IMDb.
All right, Black or White is a drama with Kevin Costner and Octavia Spencer as a mixed-race couple. Not mixed-race couple. What am I talking about? A grieving widower is drawn into a custody battle over his granddaughter, whom he helped raise her entire life. There you go. So evidently, Kevin Costner's son married Octavia Spencer. He's carked it, and Kevin Costner now wants a share of the grandchild. Seems like weepy material, doesn't it? But Kevin Costner still making films.
Sounds like a really racist... That's a pretty racist title, though.
What's I thought it was a Tyler Perry film.
Yeah, it is... maybe there is a tendency, isn't there, towards films that will... The subtlety.
They're a white view of black culture. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah. Well, like, no. I'm just. It's not just.
They're telling black stories through white eyes, and it's really disingenuous.
Totally. But this. I mean, that trend isn't just in terms of race, but it's in terms of films generally. You know, like just find the simplest, clearest, stupidest title that they can, because you know, heavens no, you wouldn't want to confuse an audience or make them feel stupid.
Moving along quickly.
In the UK, that's what we've got to do. I do that one, don't I?
Yes.
Right, here
Your
we go.
Your official UK voice.
I shall put on my British accent for this because Actually, no, number five is Taken 3, still making squillions of dollars all over the world, no matter how bad it is. Number four, The Theory of Everything. Number three in the UK, American Sniper. Pleased to see that that isn't dominating the entire international box office. Number two, Kingsman, The Secret Service. Colin Firth and Samuel L. Jackson, that opens today, actually, here in New Zealand, if you're listening on the day we record, which you can't because we're not going to put it out until tomorrow. And number one in the United Kingdom, Big Hero 6, which is actually first week out. I'm amazed because it's actually just been released on home video in America, which is you would have thought was a recipe for piracy.
They had a really weird release schedule for that overseas, though.
But isn't that the case often with big family animated stuff, is that they try and time in with whatever they think is the prime school holidays stuff? So and Britain, it is weird. And it's like Frozen coming out really late in Japan and then playing and playing and playing and playing and playing and playing.
Remember when we were young and films like Ghostbusters and Batman didn't come out here until 6 months after the American release? Star Wars was the same. It didn't come out till December, and it was out in America in May.
Yeah, because it was all about the summer. It was all about summer blockbusters in those days. Yeah, exactly. And it was just this intense desire, the waiting. I don't know how we survived it, how we did not explode with excitement about all of that. But here we are to tell the tale. What was your biggest film of the 80s, Steve? Like, what was the one that you that because there's been all this talk, this is about Ghostbusters being remade as an all female Ghostbusters,
and people had that whole sort of arrogance of those actors in it and stuff.
Oh my God, people's childhoods are being not.
Oh, don't say that.
No, I'm not going to use that word.
Not like that. Yeah, it's just because they've got no originality or anything.
Mm.
It has my head in. I mean, like, because so often these remakes, I mean, they're remaking all my favourite old trashy films like Last House on the Left as well. Everything's getting remade, and they always, always do it badly.
Mm. Is there a film that if they remade it, you would be personally offended? Because
they already have Poseidon Adventure, which is one of the first films I saw, and I just sat there crying my little eyes out as an 8-year-old. And I just thought the remake would miss the whole plot.
Yeah.
Well, the scenes, But yes, they've already done it.
Right. Oh, God. How depressing is that? See, I haven't seen the remake of it, but I have a fondness for Shelley Winters. And so, you know, I'm a big fan of the original. But in terms of disaster movies of the 70s, the film that absolutely terrified the bejesus out of me, and probably when I go to sleep still does, is The Towering Inferno.
That was great. And it's got Paul and Steve. How can you lose?
I know. Amazing films. And Fred Astaire's in it.
Yeah. And Jennifer Jones. I mean, I saw Earthquake when it was in Fence Around, although I don't know if it was then.
In New Zealand, probably not.
Yeah. Yeah, they had the ad. I don't think it was.
Were they installing Fence Around in Hamilton? I don't think so.
I don't either.
No, but there you go. I mean, that was a great era of disaster movies. The Towering Inferno was absolutely incredible. I couldn't.
It was stunning.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's going on the list. It's going on the list for rewatches very soon.
My mother used to say something that drove me nuts. Problems don't stay problems. They turn into something else.
What do they turn into?
I don't know yet.
What about your mommy?
She died.
My mother's a singer. She has taught me many songs. Would you like to hear one?
Yeah.
From this valley, they say you are leaving.
Kaylee, you have you were the first of us to see Wild, and you saw it.
It was the first of many.
Yeah. Tell us about it.
Casually. Well, Wild stars Reese Witherspoon.
Now tell us about where you saw it. Don't just give us
Skype. Fine. I saw Wild at Telluride at its world premiere at Telluride Film Festival this year, just casually. I didn't get to go to the big premiere night, but I did have a chance to see it while I was working. Actually, I was able to sneak in during my shift and watch it on one of the morning sessions. And it stars Reese Witherspoon. It's the new film by Jean-Marc Vallée, who did Dallas Buyers Club. And it's based on the book by Cheryl Strayed. And it's Cheryl Strayed... Reese Witherspoon plays Cheryl Strayed. She, without spoiling anything of what happens, because the film has a lot of flashbacks that sort of tell you the story, she's basically hit rock bottom, decides to sort of pack everything away and walk the Pacific Coastal Trail, which goes from the border of Canada and the US to the border of Mexico and the US. So it's a very, very long walk. And sort of reclaim her life by backpacking across America through some very intense conditions.
And good synopsis.
Yeah, no, it is a good synopsis. And how long does it take her to do it in actual sort of real time? Because I was getting a little bit confused. It seemed to me that I was expecting her, it would have taken, you know, months, but it wasn't months, was it? It was like 11 weeks.
Like 3 months, wasn't it?
Yeah, 11, 12 weeks or something. Yeah,
because the entire... I don't know if she hiked the entire trail. The entire trail is over 2,000 kilometers. So I don't know if she did the entire thing, but she
IMDb says 1,100 miles. So
okay, she didn't do the whole thing. Yeah. Lazy.
Cheat. Get back. Go back and finish it.
There's a bit in the middle of the film where it's snowing, so she had to get a ride, so she missed some of it out at that bit.
Yeah, she did sort of cheat.
Yeah,
yeah.
But this is a film about discovering yourself and rediscovering yourself when you feel like you've gone off the rails. And did it touch you personally? Did you connect to it?
I went into this actually having pretty low expectations. Even at Telluride, because I was like, oh, Reese Witherspoon, it's about a woman who decides to, you know, go on this big trip. I was expecting Eat, Pray, Love. Like, I really wasn't expecting much. But being in Telluride by myself and traveling across parts of the US and Canada by myself, I sort of got drawn into it a bit. I mean, obviously I wasn't hiking to Chicago, I was taking the Amtrak, but I think I watched it at just sort of the perfect moment of my life last year when I was traveling and I was by myself. And
the bigness of
America and going to Telluride for the first time and doing all these things for the first time was quite good. I wouldn't say it was the best film I saw at Telluride, but it did exceed my expectations, even though my expectations were very low.
I thought it was excellent cinema. It made me realize how little cinema is made with women as the protagonist and focusing on them, and without it having to be like an action film or something, or just a woman actually looking at herself. And because I went in thinking, oh, it's going to be something's happened to children, but it wasn't. It was all about events that had happened to her, which weren't specifically that huge, but in the whole, you know, in the roundness of life, it really had sort of taken her down. Yeah, I was really surprised. I was moved by it immensely.
I was very surprised by it too, Steve, in that I was really impressed by the storytelling and the fact that the intelligence behind the editing and the choice of when to go back into her past life and how much of her past life to show. Sometimes they were only seconds, you know, little flashes, which is sort of what memory does for us in real life.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I didn't like Dallas Buyers Club. I think it's a very disingenuous, untrue story. And so I didn't have anything like that in this. And then I was like, this is quite skilled filmmaking. What's that test they do with women in film?
The Bechdel test. The Bechdel test.
And I thought this is like the perfect example of it's not about men at all. It's about a woman and it's about herself as well. And it just struck me so clearly halfway through it how rarely cinema like this is made.
And also the great thing is the screenplay was written by Nick Hornby, who's one of my favorite authors. I really like his books. And his books have been moved into cinema are quite good as well. So there's a very talented director. There's a very talented writer behind it. Plus, it's based on this pretty fantastic true story written by a woman about just being herself and doing her thing.
It wasn't until the end that I realized that it was based on a true story and an autobiographical book, because I found myself getting kind of frustrated because when she leaves these notes in the guest books of various places and she'll quote a great American poet and then she'll say, and Cheryl strayed, you know, she'll just like take ownership of that particular thought, which is a cool thing to do. It's not a bad thing to do, but her surname seemed so unfortunately metaphorical that I couldn't believe. It's like, man, if somebody had written that, I would be wanting to give them a slap and saying, go back and start again.
That's
please.
Her actual name.
But no, it's her actual name, and it's like,
yeah,
that's
ridiculous. I watched it with a couple of women, and there were a few times I got nervous because, like, when she was with those men, they were all like, oh, she's going to get raped or something. And it also makes me realize of how often women are depicted as victims in cinema, and that in so many films are like that as well. And it was like but it didn't happen. And that was like so refreshing as well. It was just, she was actually on a journey.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether she found herself. I just think she actually made peace with herself and with her past. And in the end, didn't like let it go, but let it become a part of it, which I think is so important. You can't let these things go and forget them. They're a part of you. They're things that you've lived through. So you have to accept that. And I thought that's a really clearly nice theme that was in the film.
For me, those moments where she appeared to be in peril from the men around her, that. And yes, I'm really glad that that nothing, spoiler alert, nothing actually too disastrous happened to her. But it was made really clear to me how women must feel
the time. What life is like for women every day. Yes. It's really, yeah, and that's something that's never seen on screen. And I thought they covered it beautifully.
It was very, very sensitively done, wasn't it? And so I want to come back to Dallas Buyers Club just for a moment there, Steve, because I know your problems with it. But you can see that Jean-Marc Vallée as a director has got some chops in terms of actually, you know, maybe with Dallas Buyers Club, the story or the script or the wasn't quite there, but you know, you'd be wanting to see his next film, wouldn't you?
Yeah, after this, I would, which is funny because after Dallas Buyers Club, I saw off anything that any of those people were involved in. Then, of course, I saw Interstellar, which is the worst idea in the world, so I've gone off Matthew McConaughey again. But I mean, you can't compare them. Wilder is so far superior to the total fakeness of Dallas Buyers Club. It's like they're not even in the same sphere of cinema and of storytelling and of themes or anything. Wild is head and shoulders better than anything in Dallas Buyers Club, in which they just, I know I can't even talk about it, I'll just get angry.
No, that's fine. We wouldn't want to upset you. It's the night before Waitangi Day. We're supposed to all be on holiday soon. So
it's a day of remembrance.
I'll say seriously, Wild is so worth seeing, and your expectations that you'll go into it will. You won't expect what you get, which is a really honest, beautiful film.
I was reminded through watching it of my favourite film of 2007, which was Into the Wild. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, no, I didn't. Because that's funny. I didn't want to see Wild because I just can't stand those people going on adventures and old boohoo white men and chips. You know, blah, I just don't care. I watched like 5 minutes of Into the Wild. I gave up in 127 hours, 5 minutes, gave up. I just didn't care about them. And in this, it just grabbed me right from the start. Because I thought she was so prepared for it as well. I was like, what an idiot. And then, of course, I did the research, and that's how she actually started off herself, totally ill-prepared in every way.
And, sorry to interrupt. That was one of my favorite parts, because it was so realistic. It's like her boots don't fit, and her backpack, you know, gives her blisters, and she didn't have the right canister. And I'm like, yeah, that's actually what it's like when just people just decide to go hiking. They get it wrong.
And I think that's an interesting journey as a film goer as well, that you kind of don't actually like her at the start, and then by the end I think you do a lot.
Mm.
Oh, absolutely. I would recommend that both of those films that you gave up after 5 minutes, if you liked Wild, I think that there's a gender difference, and yes, they're different kinds of filmmaking. Although Into the Wild, which was made by Sean Penn, has a lot in common with this film, particularly the structure, but, you know, somebody going off into the wilderness to find themselves effectively, and flashbacks being used to illuminate what has taken them on that journey, or propelled them on that journey. And actually 127 Hours does the same thing, you know, finds them. You learn through flashback. So I would encourage you.
I'm sorry, I don't watch James Franco films. I boycott him. I'm North Korea when it comes to James Franco. But
fair.
I will do
I'm
it
in that
well for you.
Into the I would love you to, and because you know, it was my favorite film of 2007. It was a film that moved me greatly, and I think it would make a really interesting comparison with Wild, because the outcomes are so different, and that in itself, those choices, I mean, apart from the fact that they're two real life stories, whether that's a gender thing or an age thing or the times that the film were made or set, who knows? The whole thing fascinates me. All we're going to come up with here is that Wild is something that you really must see.
It really works, and it's a film that, like, women I know who've had relationships with their mother, either positive or not, I'm telling them to go, because I think that might be a bit, you know, cathartic and bit of recognition for them as well. Because Laura Dern's the mother, and it's a really good performance.
Oh, full credit to her.
Oh, it's so much fun. She reminds me of me. Laura Dern.
Well, you could do worse. Let's go around the room now. We like to sum up with two words. We are nothing if not reductive on this program. Mm-hmm. So, Kaylee, do you want to start with two words for Wild?
My two words for Wild would be beautiful journey.
Okay, I'm going to come up with just go.
That's good. Awesome. Rare beauty.
Nice work. Nice work, all of you. Very pleased with that. And we're big fans of Wild here on the show. So now it's time for
and
some
good
news.
Good on Reese for producing it as well and getting that on screen.
Well, and not just that, because actually she was supposed to be doing Gone Girl. And when it came to when it came to the clash, she's still a producer on Gone Girl, but she went, you know what? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do this. When it comes to, you know.
Wise woman.
Exactly. All right, let's go for the news.
Big news for films fans. That's people who actually love celluloid. You know, Christopher Nolan and Martin Scorsese, people like that. Kodak have done a deal with the Hollywood studios to continue to provide 35mm stock for those directors that want it, such as J.J. Abrams and Judd Apatow.
Because apparently the new Star Wars film is being shot on film. And somebody,
you know, I was 12, 13 when Star Wars the original came out, and I lined up and I saw it so many times, and I just didn't care about the new one at all, because those last three did it, and also it's China reaction to youth of people, and it's like, I just don't care about it. I didn't care about the trailer, but that's good news for film fans.
It is good news for film fans. It's good news for Christopher Nolan. And
Interstellar.
I'm glad you thought it was risible as I did. But it's really good that filmmakers are going to have this choice.
Yeah.
And you know, I personally don't necessarily see it anymore, the difference between 35mm film and digital. I think that lens, things like lenses and cameras are more important than the actual thing, the chemical that process that's going on. God, 2 years ago, no, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I would have strung myself up if I'd said that. But you know, I love watching films projected digitally now. I love the fact that I'm watching the same film that everyone else in the world is watching, not the scratched, beaten up, damaged version.
We always used to get such bad prints because we're at the end of the run for a lot of films as well.
Exactly. But I do like the fact that when it comes to cinematography and capture, that people have some choices now. And who knows? You know, it might mean some interesting creative choices.
Cool. Sundance came and went with differing results for the two features shot in New Zealand. Zed for Zachariah, starring, wait for it, Chiwetel Ejiofor. Mm-hmm. I looked it up.
And I spelled it wrong in the script, sorry.
Chris Pine and Margot Robbie got mixed reviews, while Slow West, the Western starring Michael Fassbender and Cody Smith McPhee, and featuring some actual Kiwi actors, won the Grand Jury Prize for World Cinema. Not bad.
Yeah, it's Slow West, which I think they shot for 6 weeks here in New Zealand, in the South Island, doubling for most of America.
Yeah, we were on Fassbender alert, looking out for him.
And he's been, but he's been back since doing the Lighthouse, that Lighthouse film that they were shooting in Nelson. So, I mean, Fassbender's been here several times in the last 12 months. But here we go. Like, if you know Kiwi actors, you'll know that, I mean, people like this will be interesting. You know, Errol Shand is in Slow West. Madeline Sami. Jeffrey Thomas, Shark in the Park. he got a part in it. And Brooke Williams, the wonderful Brooke Williams, also got a role in that. So, yeah, quite a few Kiwi actors got parts. And Ben Mendelsohn, who the last thing we saw was him eating up the scenery in Exodus. Hopefully somebody's directed him to be a little bit less noisy. But anyway, Slow West, can't wait. Not on anybody's release schedule yet, but I would be amazed if it hasn't come out before or during the festival.
Mm-hmm. At 79, Woody Allen is a few years younger than Clint Eastwood and is therefore determined to let him keep the title of the hardest working pensioner in Hollywood. On top of the recent announcement that he would be writing and directing a TV series for Amazon, he recently confirmed his latest feature film project, Irrational Man. It would be released later this year by Sony Pictures Classics. The film stars Joaquin Phoenix, Parker Posey, and Emma Stone.
Parker Posey's too good for him. I love my Parker Posey.
Yeah, well, I'm just really pleased Parker Posey got a job.
Yeah, she rocks. I used to sing a song about her in the 80s, which went, Parker Posey, she's the one, because she's ubiquitous, which means she's in everything, because she's Parker Posey. The one, just goes on and on like that.
Well, you can bring back the song.
I also pronounce ubiquitous. I'm glad you didn't say this thing. You're sweet.
And in other news about veteran filmmakers, Terrence Malick's next film, Voyage of Time, is going to be financed and screened through the IMAX network in the US.
So, Terrence Malick.
Voyage of Time.
Does sound a bit...
Badlands.
It does sound... Yeah, Badlands, that was... Yeah, that's a long time ago, though, isn't it?
But Badlands is great.
I'm a big fan of Terrence Malick, although I can't really say that, actually, because I haven't seen the latest one.
Mm.
Most recent one was in the last festival, the Ben Affleck one.
Mm.
Was in the last...
I gave up after Badlands.
Yeah, that's quite a long time ago.
I think it was in the festival.
72, honey.
Yeah. Okay. I'm gonna pretend I didn't hear that, because that would imply that we would have to have a big fight off air about that, and we won't. Anyway.
I sort of started Days of Heaven, and it was like, I'll cut to the chase.
No, sometimes the chase isn't as important as the vibe.
I know.
The vibe you're on.
I love annoying film fanatics by saying things like that as well, and it's true, which is worse.
All right, let's get very serious now, because it's time that we all went on Johnny Depp career death watch alert.
3 months ago, a Spanish museum sent a Goya painting to be cleaned. The painting has disappeared. This very bad man who wanted to fund violent worldwide revolution. Countless lives are at stake.
And you would like me to find it?
Precisely. What is in it for me, as they say?
Do it for Queen and country.
No. All right, Queen and country, travel and living expenses, reasonable overhead. Done.
We saw the trailer for this film at something a couple of weeks ago, and all of us stared at each other and went, what on earth is this? Mordecai, Johnny Depp.
It's come from nowhere, hasn't it?
It has.
It's so bizarre.
And it's going nowhere.
And when I left the film, I still thought, what on earth is this?
Well, but it really sort of plays like one of those sort of classic bad films like Hudson Hawk and, you know, all that real, when there was a lot of money around, they just made rubbish.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, we've got one actor, so let's just con other people to do it and then build it around that. But it's so bad.
The things like Hudson Hawk have been, there's been an element of reinterpreting or revisiting those films, you know. Like, I do believe that there's an element of the film community that when they smell blood in the water, they all, you know, they all pile on, and a film just gets destroyed by... And it's worse in the days of in these days of social media and Facebook. I mean, it used to be just critics would all just they would all look at each other as they came out of a media screening and go, "Should we kill it? Yeah, let's kill it." And but now, you know, and so a film that, you know, where it does, you know, it's not a great film, and you, it just feels like.
Everyone's
is it that? Yeah, exactly.
I don't agree, because the reason I use Hudson Hawk is it's like, because that was just so, like, you know, Richard E. Grant and Sandra Bernhardt leaping around the scenery and eating it and chewing it out. And that's what this was like. Everyone, like, no one just said, what are you doing here? What are you playing? Well, there was nothing to play anyway, so I had to play broad. But when you let actors go crazy, it's always unfortunate. And that's what I thought this was.
And it all starts with Depp, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. What was he thinking? What's that accent? What's Goopy doing in it, even though she's hardly in it? I mean, she can do a better English accent than that. She did a really good one in Sliding Doors years ago when she started off. And with this, I was like, what's she playing here? Who wants to do the story synopsis?
Okay, I'll do that. I slept through the middle bit, so I...
How did I?
So, you know, it didn't really make that much sense to me, but it was something about a stolen Goya painting, Charlie Mordecai, played by Johnny Depp, being a famous art dealer, but also an English lord, having an enormous amount of problems with back taxes, and who's going to lose the house, and blah de blah de blah. And so he decides there's some kind of scheming around this this painting, and covering it with some other kind of painting that he already owns, and selling it to somebody who's a bit of a dupe. And look, I tell you what, I did lose it a little bit in terms of the actual plotting. And even though it's not that dense, it just... I didn't care enough to pay attention to it, and then
you fell asleep.
And then I fell asleep, and I couldn't, and I also couldn't tell you how long I fell asleep for.
Hmm.
Because there's no through line or anything, and there is no real story to such to grab onto.
No, but there are a lot of English actors cashing checks very happily. You know, this is like some of those English, it's like all the English actors that didn't get onto Game of Thrones and get on that bandwagon. You know, can we have all the old English actors, please, for this Johnny Depp film? Well, most of them are in Iceland actually doing Game of Thrones, so you'll have the leftover ones if that's all right. Oh, they'll do.
And then two American actors for when they go to America.
Yeah.
I mean, I also thought there was a really nasty sort of casual hate in it, like when the woman at the start's killed and he says something like, oh, now, and you're just going to start with killing a hag. And I was like, why is he describing her like that? It's just totally hateful and there's no reason for it. And there are lots of little bits like that that just pop up and it's like, ooh, what awful language.
It is. There is a nastiness about it, and there is a callousness and an a thoughtlessness behind the characters, and I can imagine that in different hands that would be a really funny black comedy. Like if the Coen brothers got that sort of topic, they might have turned it into something really watchable. In fact, when I was watching the film, I was reminded of a film that is actually even worse than this. Hard to believe, I know. And that's Gambit, which starred Colin Firth as an art dealer, sort of auctioneer, trying to pull a stunt over over some kind of art thing. And that was a script that was written by the Coen brothers but not directed by them. And it was like, oh, man, you know, don't just buy their scripts. You've got to buy them.
Halfway through, I thought they were like maybe trying to do a Wes Anderson type thing, like quite broad characters and quite broad story strokes, but then it just didn't even get close to anything of Wes's at all.
So can we just go around and find out who do we blame for this? Like, if we were going to put heads on spikes,
I don't even know who directed it.
Well, I'm about to tell you, David Koop. David Koop. Let's. What else has he done?
Mission Impossible.
No. Let's look for directing credits. 9 directing credits. Premium Rush. Premium Rush was the one that didn't get released here with the Cycle Courier in New York. That's
yes.
Right.
With Gordon Joseph Levitt.
Yes.
Yep, that's right. He made Ghost Town with Ricky Gervais. Secret Window with
Johnny Depp.
With Johnny Depp, hence the relationship there. And that Stir of Echoes. Carl, that rings a bell. What was Stir of Echoes?
Is it Kevin Bacon, isn't it?
It is Kevin Bacon. Well done. Okay, so what we've got is we've got a hack here.
Yeah. He makes a second string type movie. That, if you want to buy this, you've got to buy that as well. Like they do the TV all the time now.
Yeah. And you know what? This is a film that needed somebody like the guy who directed Pirates of the Caribbean. You know, like needed somebody who has a real visual and editing vision for humor.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't believe that this idea was a completely dead in the water idea, except on the basis that, when Johnny Depp plays these made up, extreme characters, they work best when he's a supporting character, not the lead.
Totally.
Right? And so Pirates of the Caribbean, he's not in every scene. So he drifts in and out and he elevates the moments that he's involved in. Same thing happened in Alice in Wonderland, and the same thing happened in a film that I think is much maligned, Lone Ranger, which is a film that I've seen a couple of times and we really liked it here. And I know a lot of people who did. And that's a film that, if it seemed to me, did not deserve the opprobrium that it got and everyone piled on then.
I mean, I did. I thought it was the Wild Wild West.
No, it's better than that. It's got a great chase.
Awful film that needed someone to say stop it.
It was definitely over the top, and it was definitely extreme. But we're very fond of it in this house. So,
these situations, for me, it comes down to the director not going, pull your head in a bit. It's just too broad, and that's why all those films you like mentioning now just didn't work for me, like Lone Ranger, because it's just too whoa. Styles, that kind of style's hard to get. Wes Anderson hits it perfectly. You know, let the actors go. They're still playing an honesty, whereas stuff like this just doesn't have it at all.
But there's also an ability as a director to understand how gags work. And jokes work and how you shoot those things. And it's not just the question of planting a camera and letting them do whatever they want. You know, you've still got to understand how you edit for gags, edit for humor. And all of that fails, you know. I do feel like this is not the worst film that I've ever seen. And it's not necessarily a completely misguided, like, if Depp's a producer, right? So, somebody handed him the script and this idea and he went, you know what, I'd really like to play this and maybe there's some potential there and what have you, but he chose the director. And so he's got to be responsible for the fact that, somebody, a stronger personality like Tim Burton maybe might have actually said, you know what, I want less of that. I want you to, or I'm going to bring you in for a third of the film rather than all of the film. You're not carrying the whole thing on your shoulders when the entire character is based on a moustache. It's not a strong enough thing. Anyway, I mean, I've ranted about it. Steve?
No, it just doesn't work at all. And I don't think you can say it's not, really bad. I think it is really bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the fact that we both went to sleep, I don't know about it, you, but when I'm a really bad film setting me, but I'm a cheerleader in a Serbian film, my brain will shut down because it knows I need to be protected because I'm gentle, and that's what happened to me in this. It was just it's just too awful in every way, and so it shut down. And it happened to both of us, so this is pretty bad. I don't think it's, a pile-on. I think in pretty much any way you can think of what cinema should be, it doesn't work.
Indeed. No, it's a totally fair comment. I have slept through some really good films, though, in my time, so I don't want to necessarily use that as a kind of absolute.
No, of course not, but that's just for me. My brain will shut down. I suppose I'm getting really upset.
Indeed.
All right. Serbian film, no.
I haven't seen a Serbian film.
Do not watch film.
Don't.
Anytime anyone says the title of that film, you'll have nightmares for weeks.
Yeah, we use it as a metaphor now. If people are getting really horrible, we'll just go, you're being a bit Serbian film, stop it. And the person will just go, oh, sorry, I'm bad. That's just too bad. Too much.
All right.
It's all about my stuff now.
We've spent far too much time talking about bad stuff. So let's wrap this up with two words. Kaylee, do you have two words for Mordecai?
Don't go.
Yeah.
Pause.
Steve, do you have two?
Bad film. Bad. It's bad.
Yeah, I'm struggling to do.
I mean, there were some like lull moments, but it just
Is it low or lull? As in laugh out loud.
Maybe I was desperate. I got desperate to laugh.
Yeah, right.
I think
I go to films, and there are times when I think, oh, you know what? I'm gonna measure this on the basis of how many actual laugh out louds there are, and every so often, like The Wedding Ringer, got one. So here's the thing: is that I've seen The Wedding Ringer, and Mordecai is not as hateful as The Wedding Ringer.
Mm.
Oh yeah, that kid on Hard Guy is horrific.
He is horrific, and the fact is, he's now one of the biggest stars in the world. So we are stuck with him until he decides to have a bit of a breakdown and retire, like
Chappelle. But Chappelle was making amazing stuff.
Yeah, yeah, not just Chappelle, but sorry, I'm just trying to remember that. The Jackie Chan movies, the...
Chris Tucker.
Oh, Chris Tucker. Yeah, Chris Tucker just decided, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe we can just, if we hope hard enough, maybe Kevin Hart will just go, I don't want to do this anymore. Anyway.
Open dream.
All right. Steve, I want to talk to you now. Like, we've talked about things that make us mad and frustrate us, but you are a big enthusiast for great current television, and I know that you're, you know, so what should we be searching out either on Soho Channel or on
Lightbox or Nova coming up?
Yeah, exactly. Or putting your name down for the Fatso box, DVD box set.
Well, you know, I said look, in last year that it was a golden age for British TV, and I really believe it because when I was young, I was obsessed with American. It was all I watched, and there's a lot of British stuff I'd missed. And then now I've sort of been watching all the new stuff and going back a bit, and there's so much. They're really hitting the mark, eh? And they've been really honest about their society. And even like Grantchester, which stars James Norton, who is just horrifically good. He was in Happy Valley as the psychotic, which is set in the 50s. But you know how usually English stuff's quite jaunty and fun, but this has a lot of comments on it about bigotry. There's a whole storyline about gays in the 50s that's incredibly honest. About xenophobia after the war, and I was like, wow, this is like all the rubbish we used to watch when we were young. They're like finally telling the true side of it. I mean, there'll always be rubbish like Downton Abbey, which isn't going to tell the truth about the class system and how that affected the poor. But I was like really surprised that Grantchester really hit the mark so strongly. The Guilty I really loved with that woman from Green Wing, Thames, and blah, blah, blah. It's very similar to The Missing, which is playing now on TV1, but it's only three parts. And it has a twist in the tail that just ripped my head off.
Is she not being funny in this?
No, she did a drama, I know. And I was like, oh, how's this going to work? Because, you know, quite often when comics do this, it doesn't work. But just recently I finished Jimmy McGovern's Accused. I've been rewatching a lot of the old Jimmy McGovern stuff because I did Cracker, and I was like, boy, this is great TV. So I did Accused, and the guy, I can't remember his name, Rob Blissen or something, really good dramatic role. And I was like, you know, comics can do good stuff as well. They can really work it. The thing that's blown me away in the last couple of weeks is Adam Curtis, the documentarian. Do you know his work?
No, I don't. But give me some background. So where would you start?
He was for the BBC. He still kind of is. And he did Century of the Self, which was about Freudian view, you know, Freudian psychology being used by his nephew in America to train Americans to start purchasing, to go from savers to buyers because they needed it. It's incredibly dense stuff, but he uses like, he must watch endless stuff, and he just uses these like images from pop culture of the time to illustrate his point of what he's saying. And that sort of went up to like the mid-1990s. And then the next one I saw of his was The Power of Nightmare, which is post 9/11, which sort of tells you things about how Al-Qaeda doesn't exist and how they turned us into being fearful of everything. His latest piece is Bitter Lake, which is on YouTube and stuff, so you can see it. And that, well, it's Bitter Lake. Do you know about that?
No.
Saudi King in 1945 made the deal with Roosevelt, with Saudi Arabia and America, to keep the oil flowing. And basically the deal is you can do what you want there in Saudi Arabia, just give us the oil. And so it sort of explains everything, like why some nations were totally demonized, whereas Saudi Arabia, where they're still, you know, decapitating people is fine and no one says anything about it or cares about it. And so pretty much it puts everything that is happening now into the news, into a context of history, of knowing where these deals came from. And I'm watching it going, oh my God, this is why stuff is happening, and this is why Saudi Arabia gets away with it. And, you know, John Key's now encouraging us to invade wherever ICE is, or ISIS. And but it's like, well, why are we ignoring all these other, you know, horrific events, you know, genocides, basically. You know, West Papua, 500,000 killed since the 65 events, and no one cares about it, no one talks about it. That's not getting talked about. But then on the other side, you've got all this, oh no, but we've got to go in and invade there. It's one of the best things. Adam Curtis is just my dream. He's like Ken Burns gone big, and like instead of doing this, he does historical, but he puts it into context of what's happening now. And I think that's what we're missing from the news media. We don't get the context of where things are coming from. And Bitter Lake is just like, you should watch all of them. Centuries of Self, Power of Nightmares, although some of that now is a bit, and Bitter Lake. But Bitter Lake, I think, because he found all this footage from Afghanistan, which is normally what it is about. So it just covers everything. It's like 2.5 hours of pure heaven. The other good TV that's coming, How to Get Away with Murder, the new Sondra Rhimes. I haven't handled anything like that, but this is really, really good. I'm sure it'll be cut on New Zealand. And do you like Hustle and Flow?
I don't know. That's a movie, isn't it?
Yep. He played the pimp who runs the woman and then
that's right.
Become a rap star. This, I'm saying, is Hustle and Flow 20 years later, and it's brilliant. It's the same woman who played the really lovely sex worker for him in Hustle and Flow. She's now Cookie, who gets out of prison in the first episode, and she wants her share of the millions that he's made since she went down for him to cover up that they made all their money from drugs. And it's like Dallas. It's like a black Dallas, but incredibly of the now. I know, isn't it the best description ever? It's really, really fun stuff. I'm glad that a lot of the English thing here right away, Catastrophe is the best comedy I've seen in forever, and it's from Sky One. I was watching it going, oh my God, this is all my friends. This is how we talk to each other. And these are the few pettiest times I've had relationships. This is what I'm like in them, and it's so rare that relationships are honestly portrayed, and it's an English show, and it is really, really worth finding. Just hysterical. I watched Fortitude, which is playing on Soho. It was like halfway through, I went, oh, they tried to do Twin Peaks, because they had like that industrial plane. It's the worst thing I've seen for ages.
Yeah,
the actors that were in Harry Potter and stuff turn up, and it's all like,
you were scornful of that. I recall. Now, there's a film there's a television series that I don't know very much about, but I know that people are tweeting the bejesus out of it, and it's in season 3 or something. Is that Justified?
Oh, yeah, no, it's just finishing in America now. Yeah, I think season 3 started here. That's really good. Timothy Oliphant. Could I do say, I got into trouble with you, I think, when I said I'm finding a lot better scenes being explored in TV than in movies, but it was in the middle of my year and a half of not watching any film. And so now I'm watching again, there is some good stuff. But TV's really hitting its mark. And I think it's because it is such a diverse market now. Yeah, Justified's really beautiful. Also, Longmire's really nice as well. I haven't seen any of the Swedishy, Danishy dramas that everyone raves about that all seem very dour and full of snow.
They're very long.
Them as well.
Yeah, they've.
Have you seen any of them?
No. Oh, I mean, I've tiptoed a wee bit through them, and my parents are really into those, The Killing, and you know, good, but they're very long, and I must admit that, you know, time being of the essence, I feel like if you're going to commit, you need to commit, and so we will get to them, and we will tiptoe our way through them. We've been watching here a series of three television movies called the Waraker Trilogy, which is Bill Nighy playing a spy, a British spy, in three films, written and directed by David Hare.
Oh, wow. He's an excellent playwright.
Exactly. And so my parents recommended this to me at Christmas and lent me the box set, actually. And we watched the last one last night. Disappointing in that, you know, it's kind of like sub Le Carre, you know, like you want tighter plotting. He's got a very strong political sense, and he's got a very strong sort of sense of right and wrong, but he's not a great plotter. And so what you want in these spy things is you want a few twists and turns. You don't want it to just be people arguing in rooms, unfortunately. But if you do find yourself tripping over that one, definitely worth a look, because Bill Nighy is always watchable and everything. And it's got
the thing I'm liking is that you can't be good and evil now. You've got to have more honest shading, because that's what society is like now. And I think once you get into that, then it's a lot. It's really fascinating. Like The Missing, which is on at the moment, that has some really good turns where you're like, oh my God, this character I've been told, I'm suddenly like, he's making choices. Would I make that choice? And I think that what's been resonating for me a lot more, you know, it's actually like you can imagine like yourself in that position, God help you. Mm-hmm. But I think you've got to have that sort of complicated characters, because I think humans are complicated, and also we often sometimes make really bad choices.
And I think,
you make a choice then and there, and that's what happens.
And I think that having story arcs that last 18 hours allow for that, which a 90-minute or even a 2.5-hour feature film struggle.
I'm liking that they're doing, they're sort of picking up more on the English thing. I mean, not having to do 22-episode shows, which is hard for anyone to write and for the actors. We're getting a lot more 8 and 10, things like Fargo and stuff. And I think that's really refreshing, and I think it's really cool on the writers and the showrunners. It's not like this endless hill they've got to climb. They can actually just go, oh, 8 and 10, and I can finish it and stuff. And you know, American Horror Story, that just now totally jumped the shark and had unprotected sex with it. But at the start, it did it really well, of like 10, 12 episodes, and knowing you've got an end and you can finish your story. That's really refreshing.
Steve, I'm just going to interrupt you there, because time has run out on us. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here at Rancho Notorious.
Always lovely talking.
And we will get you back to talk more about television, because it is something that, you know, we don't talk about enough on this show.
Cool. No, I'd love to. And also, theory of everything, I thought it wasn't a disease film. I thought it was about living with it. I thought it was nice to have the honesty of the sexuality of the characters, and Anthony has done a really fine job with it. And I don't care if they don't cover the science, because I don't understand it. I don't go to the movies for it.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you've enjoyed this episode of Rancho Notorious, you can subscribe to us at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, where you'll find ways to communicate with us via email, or you can make a comment on the website. There's all sorts of ways you can do it. Kaylee's lost the page, even though you know it off by heart.
You can find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle's at Rancho Podcast. That's RANCHO Podcast, all one word. Where we tweet incessantly about things we think are interesting and we like, and you know, it's things that you tweet us. It's pretty casual.
It's a conversation,
yeah,
isn't it?
And you can also find us on Letterboxd. Our username is Rancho Notorious. Do I have that right?
You do, yeah. Rancho Notorious is the same as the Twitter.
Doing this for almost a year now.
Same as the Twitter handle.
Thank you, Kaylee. You're lovely.
Oh, thanks.
We all think so too here. The show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 2 is executive produced by Robert Catto, Random Films, Claire Quiray, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson, and Matthew Buchanan. The theme music is Ennio Morricone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly by Loz Plantronics. You can buy that at the iTunes store. We're going to play out with some more music. Now, Wild has a terrific soundtrack if you're of a certain age. I think it probably has a bit more of an appeal to people of my vintage. But we're going to play you out with a minor classic. This is a fantastic song from the Shangri-Las, I Can Never Go Home Anymore. Special thanks to our guest Steve Gray. Hurry back Duran Jonah Dory is soon. And special thanks to my partner, Karen, who makes sure, fiance Karen, I should update the script there, who makes sure that everyone who visits us here at Rancho Notorious is well fed, well watered, and well looked after. Thanks very much to Kaylee. And you're back on Radio New Zealand on Sunday afternoon?
No, I had my two Sundays, the last two Sundays, and I think I'll be back on Radio New Zealand in a couple months. So
we will alert the media.
Yes.
Or, thanks to everybody for listening. We're off for dinner. And so that's good evening from me,
and
Dan Slater.
And from me, Kaylee Carruthers. I'm gonna hide if she don't leave me alone. I'm gonna run away. Don't. 'Cause you can never go home anymore. Listen, does this sound familiar? You wake up every morning, go to school every day, spend your nights on the corner, just passing time away. Your life is so lonely, like a child without a toy. Then a miracle, a boy. And that's called glad. Now my mom is a good mom, and she loves me with all her heart. She said I was too young to be in love, and the boy and I would have to part. And no matter how I ranted and raved, I screamed, I pleaded, I cried. She told me it was not really love, but only my girlish pride. And that's called bad. Now if that's happened to you, at this. I packed my clothes and left home that night. Though she begged me to stay, I was sure I was right. And you know something funny? I forgot that boy right away. Instead, I remember being tucked in bed and hearing my mama say, "Hush, little baby. Your mom, what I did to mine. She grew so lonely in the end. Angels picked her for their friend. Never. And I can never go home. Never. Anymore. And that's called sad.